Today we're talking about addiction. And it will be organized today with largely around your responses, so that we'll have a lot of time for discussion. I'm going to do very little presenting. But what I want to say at first is, what I envision for this time together is not so much talking about those people who we would identify as being addicted. I don't want to look at, say, in particular, or I don't want to look, focus all our attention, say, on alcoholism at the point at which the alcoholic is at a stage where they are the most caught. Rather, what I'd like to do is to talk about what I'll call the road to addiction, and sort of set up a continuum between healthy behavior and addictive behavior, and give us some ways of thinking about where we are on that path. So that's what I have in mind. I'd like to define addiction rather simply, or with some simple descriptive phrases, and then have us look at some of the things that can make for addiction. I entitled the session Addiction, What I'd Rather Not Feel, because one of the keys to understanding addiction for me is that it largely is an avoidance technique. When people are not able to cope with their feelings or with certain situations, they turn to something which can distract them from that unwanted feeling or hurt or pain, which can medicate, which can make them feel better. In that sense, the person who is addicted is not built any different from any of us. Any one of us are good candidates for being addicts of some sort, because I think all of us experience the anxiety that comes from having to deal with feelings that are unwanted or uncomfortable or simply difficult.
Or we are addicts.
Or we are. I wasn't going to tell you that, but I don't want to spend time talking about myself, I identify myself as an addict. And I'm in a particular 12-step group simply to deal with that. So I'd like us to look at our own behavior patterns. And to do that, I have basically three questions that I would like us to look at. And we'll do some listing here of things. The first is simply to start with, what are for us? You could use either the words uncomfortable or difficult or unwanted feelings or situations, hard situations to deal with. What are for us things that we find difficult to cope with? Feelings, situations, experiences.
Painful emotions.
Okay, and
anger,
list some.
Anger.
Anger.
Loneliness.
Okay.
Devastating illnesses.
Yes. Boy, it just shakes every time. Illness. Okay. Did you have other things in mind with painful experiences? We have anger and loneliness. It seems like there are probably more.
Bereavement.
Sure, grief or bereavement.
Are those last two, are they addiction?
No, these right now we're just talking about feelings that or experiences that are uncomfortable or painful, unwanted, difficult to cope with. So we're just making a list. No, we're not at addiction yet.
Maybe this is too vague or general, but being out of control.
Oh, yes. Out of control or loss of control, absolutely.
Business failure.
Mm-hmm.
Business success.
Yeah.
Difficult. I'll never do that.
Fear.
Okay.
Divorce.
Family problems.
Yes. Good. Other things.
One we all have is aging.
Aging? Mm-hmm. And that can start My 3.5-year-old is showing signs of anxiety about aging, so that's...
I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff involved in our sexuality, that whole area that sometimes is very uncomfortable, especially as we move through the life stages.
Could I call it sexual identity?
Yeah, because I think it changes. For example, a woman in menopause that has to all be re-identified, I think, and it's very uncomfortable.
Yeah. I'll get this here.
Also, female identity. Stress.
Stress, a good one.
Would you say low self-esteem?
Sure.
Genetic considerations?
Like?
Any family history?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
As far as causes of addiction, I think there are. At this point, I'm looking mostly at, I'm starting in a little different place, looking just at kind of common experience feelings that we find as individuals difficult to cope with.
Boredom?
Good. There's, I mean, kind of another side of that. Maybe that's another way of saying loss of meaning in life. Maybe I'll just put that down. Do you want to add any more? I think there may be some others, but...
Anxiety?
I don't know how to word this, but spiritual struggles, questions.
Just for spiritual struggles. Sounds fine.
Fear of death?
Uh-huh. Well, let's use this list to start with. How many of you expect or have faced some of this in your life, or figure? We have that as a commonplace place to start. At this point, we don't have addiction yet. We simply have people who are human. If you're alive, this will happen to you, all right? Maybe if you die, then you found a way to avoid having to deal with these. But most of us, at some point in our life, will probably have to deal with most of this. Sometimes many of these things are happening all at once. Okay. It's no wonder that life is difficult if this is a part of what it means to be human. So what we've laid out is simply a part of the difficulty in being alive. These are some of the things you have to cope with. There's a whole other side of life that we haven't talked about, but this is what I'd like to focus on for our purposes today. That's question number one. So a second question now is, what are some ways that we might respond to these things? What can we do about it?
Denial.
Denial, okay.
Running.
Are you using that in kind of the metaphorical sense or like aerobics?
Running emotionally.
Okay.
I've often wondered about people who are sort of obsessive about their running physically.
Sure.
That isn't a way that we deny having to feel anything, because I get that euphoric high and all's well with my world, and I don't really have to deal with the darn thing.
Sure.
You know, and I look down on people and they question it.
We'll spend more time on that.
Maybe being compulsive about things.
Okay. And And what would that do? I'll just call it compulsivity.
Well, if I'm a compulsive exercise nut, I don't deal with the problems on that side, and I just involve myself in my exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Distracted?
Yes. Yep, so it becomes a distraction. And I suspect that it's probably easier to deal with the compulsive activity than it is with something like this.
Are you asking just for unhealthy responses?
Oh, no, just to build a whole list.
Okay.
We don't have to list just unhealthy responses. What we'll do is lay out a whole option of responses. What I'd like to do is lay out a whole option of responses. Because I don't know you, I don't know what kind of a list we'll build.
Right.
If there's no healthy...
It can also be very positive. For depression, for example, find it myself
mm-hmm.
moving physically, sometimes making help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That could be
dialogue?
Sure.
Might start eating.
Yes.
Substance abuse.
It's a good one.
Blame others, take it out on others.
Oh, good. Yes. And again, in that one, if you're blaming others, you focus your attention away from your own problems.
I'm thinking about being other-centered. In other words, I live my life out there,
mm-hmm.
and it looks really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if your problems are too difficult to deal with, you can find people whose problems you think you can cope with.
Like I'm going to the helping profession.
Yes. Oh, yeah. There's a woman. I just heard this from Tim Wolbrecht, who's doing some things on family this week. There's a woman that I respect highly in the field of codependency and the whole family system dynamic. And she, in her research, is willing to claim that it was something like 80 or 90% of all nurses are codependent, using her definitions. I mean, you can take that for what it's worth. I would think, pastors, you could probably push that figure up a little bit.
Watch it.
I'll speak for myself. So, we don't have to step on toes here. Other things.
You can be honest with your feelings and try to sort out what it is that you can do in the situation to alleviate some of the helplessness.
You can also take responsibility for yourself.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Good words, good words.
Big word, Bill, let T, or self, okay.
Cop out through suicide.
Sure. Well, these are ways of dealing with those problems.
By pause to reflect, half the time you don't have the problem you thought you had.
So just reflection,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Or it's not as big as you first thought it was.
Uh-huh.
You just don't understand the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Getting out of a bad relationship, bad job, is probably
okay.
Making a change.
Find a support group.
Yes. I'm going to put getting out of a bad relationship and change as two different things. Support group.
Meditation,
yep.
Self-acceptance?
Mm-hmm.
Humor can be one. And then on the bad side of, or the more negative side of that, sarcasm.
affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
Prayer.
Mm-hmm. Prayer, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay.
Do we have work up there?
No.
Surrender?
Yes.
Antisocial behavior.
Mm-hmm. And what might that do?
It could distract me. Or get me help get rid of my aggressions.
Sleep as a state.
Sleep?
Yes.
Chocolate.
No. Yeah, well, that's sort of under eating chocolate.
For substance abuse.
Change addictions from alcohol to chocolate.
Sure, just a change of addiction. Well, I think there are probably other responses, but this makes for us a good list to start with. In each of the cases over here, we're facing something that's difficult to deal with, and now we have a smorgasbord of options. It's likely that the person feeling some of these emotions or in a situation like this, in the movement towards an addictive pattern, will at some point feel as if or only see their options, say, they'll see their options very limited. They may even just see that they have one or two options. One of the things that I'm glad of is that we didn't just list all the negative ways to respond. And we might just go around and circle some of the things that we would call emotionally healthy. So
looks like there's more cares than problems, so that's a good start.
Sure, so let's just circle some. So just
or reflection.
Okay. Yeah, I think reflection is good. That's healthy. That keeps us focused on our problems.
Dialogue.
And dialogue, yes.
Support groups.
Yep, and support groups.
Prayer.
And prayer.
Meditation.
Okay, I heard. Okay.
Humor. Sometimes humor.
Okay.
It could go both ways.
And we may find some that go both ways.
Oh, I can see any of them could be either way, depending on how I go at it. Any of them. I could go at a spiritual path to the point I'm obsessed.
Yes, okay. Mm-hmm.
Affirmations.
Affirmations. Yeah, and that's a good point. That even some of those things that we might label healthy can become obsessive or compulsive.
Yeah, I don't think the thing itself is healthy. It's the way I go at it.
Right. Right.
Exercise.
There's a whole kind of block there.
Professional work.
Work.
Mm-hmm. Can be a healthy way.
Mm-hmm. Open it. Change.
I'd probably circle getting out of a bad relationship. Is,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Spiritual.
Yes. Saw that once and just lost it.
Running.
Hmm. So this could be
exercise. Yeah.
Yeah.
How can running emotionally be harder than emotionally?
Well, what we can do is we can talk about this. I'm getting some circles.
Sleep can be.
Every one wouldn't be best for every situation.
Okay.
Together.
Okay. The ones that are left appear to be the more obviously destructive or unhealthy kind of responses. The denial, substance abuse, blaming others. This one, the compulsivity, anything that becomes a distraction, that has, there's a way in which a number of these other ones that we've circled could become a way of distracting ourselves from the problem. Suicide, I can't think of anything good to say about that one. Our life being totally other-centered. There's obviously something we'd call Christian concern, but I'm not understanding that that's what's going on here. That looks like more running from our problems. But it looks like we do have a number of responses that could be very healthy. And any number, or any one of us, when faced with grief or fear or loneliness, has the, I think, ability to choose one of these kind of responses. So why do people start choosing other kinds of responses to their problems? In dialogue with other people, it feels much easier to say, oh, look, you know, there's lots of options for me to take. When you are by yourself, struggling with your grief, and if you feel isolated, I'm using grief as an example now, in that process, you may not be able to see that this is the smorgasbord of options from which you can choose. And I think one of the values of, for example, the 12-step recovery groups is that it helps you to look at this kind of array so that you see you're not just choosing one or the other. For us, for those of us who want to take a personal inventory of our life, I think what's helpful for me is to understand what happens, is to start reflecting on what I do when I'm faced with one of these situations or one of these emotions. What is it? What can I notice about my own behavior? What kicks in? One of the marks of an addictive system or of an addictive pattern is that when we are faced with, you choose one, an experience of stress or boredom, we may even at some point be conscious that we are experiencing stress or boredom. But for the person that's becoming addicted, something starts to kick in, whether it's for the alcoholic, the feeling that they need a drink, or for the overeater, the feeling that they need something to eat, or for someone who is a workaholic, if we can use that term here, feeling the need to go to work and to get some business done, and there's a host of things that can become distractions. Okay. So how can you tell if you notice that there are some things that you are using as distractions? How can you tell where you are on the continuum? There's a couple things that begin to happen. If one develops a pattern of using work or eating or alcohol as a way of distracting or medicating some of this pain, it doesn't take very long before the person begins to lose touch with the feeling that they were struggling with. Pretty soon, you have a hard time even identifying when you are stressed. One of the interesting things in recovery is that a lot of times people learn to identify those things sort of in retrospect. I'm eating, therefore I must be feeling stressed, or I must be feeling lonely, or I must be hurting. And so they work backwards from the compulsive activity. The more dramatic form of that is when one's, as they say in the first step, when one's life becomes, when they become powerless over the the addictive behavior, and their life becomes unmanageable. For the addict, it's oftentimes not obvious that their life has become unmanageable. Sometimes that has to get mirrored to them. Sometimes they really recognize that. But the first step is in recognizing at what point we're losing touch with the feelings that are starting, that precipitated the behavior in the first place. What I'd like to do is just kind of brainstorm a list of possible addictive behaviors and then open it up for some more particular discussion. It's said in most recovery circles that anything powerful or pleasurable can be addicting. Anything that fits those two descriptions. So that, using that list, exercise and mountain climbing and almost any recreational activity and food and sex, I have these things on my list, and power and money and work and gambling, another person's problems, all of those, and you could probably think of a host of others, all of which can become addicting. And their power is that they help us avoid these feelings which are difficult to cope with. I'd like to stop at that point and start with some questions. I have some other thoughts, but I'd just to kind of see where we're at right now. Yes?
One of my addictions, I have quite a number.
Sure.
One of my addictions has been workaholic.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. One of the problems with that is that I received a lot of strokes from mm-hmm. workaholic. Mm-hmm. And my goodness, people like to have me around mm-hmm. because they knew that I would be very responsible. The church gives the workaholic a lot of strokes for addiction.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what prices? I think that's true in society in general. Work is a very we have a hard time calling it an addiction because it's so accepted. So what if we're at a point where we want to say there's some that work can be an addiction, and that there's something happening in that addiction that's not healthy for us. What are the things that happen? Say, talk about work, for example.
I lost myself.
Yeah, a big one, maybe the big one, because
I was so focused on all of. I mean, I was so fragmented. I was here and I was there, and I didn't have any time for myself. None. Mm-hmm. It's still hard.
I think the addictive rush comes in doing the work for the sake of working. It's like the work itself mm-hmm. is what is addicting. It's beyond the strokes that I get from other people. It's like I get the fix mm-hmm. in doing the work and making it my life. I think this whole concept of an addictive society is really sort of a profound thing because mm-hmm. we begin to look at substance abuse as like a symptom of a deeper problem in our lives and in our society mm-hmm. as a whole, and mm-hmm. it pervades every institution, all of the major institutions.
Yes.
You know, if you take a look at that, and the characteristics, if you look at it,
mm-hmm.
are matching up to what we've identified in substance abuse.
I'm curious because my experience may not be yours along these lines. For people, when you are experiencing these kinds of things, how easy do you find it to talk to others about it? To readily find people that you can dialogue with, that you can relate to on an intimate level. Yes.
Most people that I talk to want to deny the fact that even I have any problems. You know, mm-hmm. I'll say, you know, I'll be sharing what's wrong. Oh no, I don't think you're like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see any of this.
One of the things that we discovered in a kind of a dramatic way this was 3.5 years ago, we had twin girls. 8 weeks after they were born, one of them died of sudden infant death.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd been a pastor for a long time and had dealt with a lot of different grief situations, had dealt with people in death. Thought I understood the process pretty well. The first thing that I noticed was that in church, we pray for people for 2 weeks, usually. Say prayers for them for 2 weeks, and it's all gone. People get maybe 3 days off of work. They're expected to come back. And they're just lost in the shuffle. We don't talk about anniversaries. We don't talk about sort of the grief process, at least not not in in general. There are places where that creeps up. But it felt like for us, I mean, this happened November 30th. By Christmas time, people were even hesitant to mention her name, like she never existed. That was just in a period of a few weeks. Well, we were still numb the first couple weeks. We didn't even know what was going on. And we were just beginning to feel the weight of the grief by a month, when everyone else's lives had just gone on. And the feeling was, ours should too. Now, we got ourselves into a support group and saw a grief counselor and did a number of other things right away. But I was, it was quite an aha experience for me to see how little the church did on that level. And I think the church does an equally good job, sarcasm here, of allowing people to be at any of these other places. So that there can be very easily a profound sense of isolation with that. The resources are there. There are people in the church to talk to, and one can. I don't want to say that, therefore, one can excuse addictive or compulsive behavior either acting out that's destructive for you or for others. Usually, they go hand in hand. But it's not obvious all the time. And for the person that's hurting, especially in our society, it's my contention, though I think a lot of other people have said the same thing, that we're not used to feeling pain. And we don't understand what place that has in our life. So that when we start to hurt, our thoughts are, let's make it go away.
I have a feeling that people are uncomfortable hearing about my pain when I talk about it.
Mm-hmm. I bet they are. Mm-hmm. And why? Why might they be uncomfortable in hearing about your pain?
Because it might trigger theirs.
Yes.
And they don't want mm-hmm. to even listen to
yes.
me. It's not considered being a winner.
Mm-hmm.
You feel so flawed. Mm-hmm. Like, geez, when am I going to get my life on track here so that I can enter acceptable society? And people look at you and say, are you still working with that?
Yeah.
Now on.
It's
boring to hear about it over and over again.
Mm-hmm. And you don't, if other people don't wear their problems on their sleeve like you feel like you are, think, well, what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman in my home congregation when I was growing up who went through a nasty divorce. And she was devastated, just devastated. Their kids were grown up and they had this, what she thought was a really beautiful marriage, and her husband simply just left her for another woman. She was devastated. Well, that was fine. I watched the way some of the people just kind of rushed in to care for her. But 1 year later, 2 years later, 3 years later, pretty soon, they were talking behind her back all the time. You know, she just doesn't want to get her life together. She's just on a big pity party. She's feeling sorry for herself. And when's she going to grow up and realize that this just happens to people? And on and on and on it went. So that a lot of people took a very antagonistic attitude towards her.
I bet that was because they hadn't had any kind of a grieving type experience.
They're probably scared to death that it would happen to them.
when you realize that, you know, a grief process, and this is when it's being worked on mm-hmm. in the best, healthiest manner, it takes, and I don't care whether what you're grieving for, because mm-hmm. you grieve all through mm-hmm. your life. You grieve when your children goes off to
sure.
kindergarten. You grieve
sure.
when they get married. You grieve when you have cancer. You grieve when you have a death or divorce. It takes about 2 years, and that's if it's being dealt with, you know,
mm-hmm.
honestly.
You don't get stuck in one of the...
Yeah, and if you get stuck, then it takes longer, and it doesn't all happen, you know, denial, you know, Kubler-Ross has her steps, but it switches around and stuff. So if people can't say, come up to you and honestly say, I know how you feel, because they've been there, really been there, then, yeah, if 2 years for some people, you know, is a long time to watch somebody be mm-hmm. through that grieving process.
I have
yes.
a person that I work with, we have an acquaintance who has gone through a divorce, and it was really very painful for her, and she was devastated not only emotionally but financially in every way.
Mm-hmm.
So the socioeconomic thing was just
sure.
gone. And my friend made the comment to me, he said, you know, her grief became her identity for a while, and was very put off about, geez, when are you going to get on with it?
Mm-hmm.
And get over that being your identity. And yet, you know, when I think about that, that really is what happens, I think, in that process.
I'd like my grief to be my identity for a while. And that's why I felt that grief has helped me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can deal with a bunch of people I've had. Because my church congregation, I feel they're saying they're caring, but I emotionally feel they aren't.
I think one of the things that works in that for me is that if people, if your friends or that church community feels the need to rescue you or protect you or to make it better, to fix, then, and I think there's some kind of, at least I'm imagining, some kind of gut level, something going on that knows that they can't just run in with a few words and fix it. I think somewhere at some kind of unconscious level, when you look at an experience like that, I believe that people know that it's not going to go away quickly. But if they feel responsible to make you better, and you're not getting better, they might think, that's too big for me.
That's non-therapeutic for me. I just feel terrible.
If they try to fix it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it isn't therapeutic. But they may do it for their own need. They may feel guilty that you're feeling that and they aren't. There are lots of things other people might feel.
So how do we stand by one another then in a healthy way? How can we engage in that process with people?
Good question. Mm-hmm. And that's largely what I see
each
as
other.
If we can begin to resolve that, I think then we start in motion a process that can inhibit the movement from these feelings to pretty quickly to the addictive kind of behaviors. Let's talk about that.
Were you able to confront your congregation at any level about what happened and how the caring stopped after 2 weeks?
No. For me personally, what happened is that I chose to seek out those people who continued to be supportive, or I invited people to be supportive. There were some people that I saw it in part as an educational process. There are people who didn't understand the grieving, that the grieving takes a while, and so part of what I did was to talk with some of my friends about how I'm still hurting, and I suppose there were quite a few times when I might moderate that so that it wasn't too much for them. You know, I mean, I was playing some games too, but I think that for both my wife and I, we didn't so much deal with the congregation on that particular issue as much as we tried to go outside and get all the support we needed. And then in my own ministry, I've been trying to raise up the consciousness of how that process goes on for a long time. You know, 18 months to 2 years to 3 years is kind of a minimum just to complete the first kind of big intense cycle. And how important it is to care for people along the way.
And sometimes listening. If you don't have an experience that you can say, I know how you feel, I think that you have to be real careful with those words and be real flip about it. You know, when I had cancer 2 years ago, and I had three whole communities supporting me, but not, and my friends were very careful not to just flippantly say, well, I know how you feel. And I know there were people in those communities that had cancer experience, and this was not a judgment on my part, but they have, you know, it helped me to say, well, so-and-so had that kind of surgery 10 years ago, and so-and-so I had 15 years ago. I desperately needed to see somebody with some longevity because I didn't feel like I had any longevity at all. But not one person in three communities came up to me and said, I've been there, would you like to talk? And that's fine. They've worked it through and gone on with their life. And so I pretty much put it off for a couple of years thinking that I had it all together. And then last fall I went into now what I know was a very deep depression. And then in this past February, I started attending a support group, and I cannot tell you, every time I opened my mouth for the first 4 weeks, all these heads were going up and down and back and forth. And, well, yeah, that's how chemo affected me, and how much of your hair did you lose, and da-da-da-da. You know, because they could honestly say, even though all their cancers were not like mine, they could honestly say, I know how you feel. So I think the first thing is to listen, and then if it goes to a point where you think that person needs some support, then say, I can listen for you, and I can be there for you, but I don't know how you feel, and maybe direct them to some resources.
Just a general, that's really good to hear that, kind of a general comment. I think it's important for us to be deliberate about who we entrust our problems to. And that requires some honesty in ourselves. Sometimes we can want to be stuck here because we're maybe afraid of the next stage of life. I mean, there can be other dynamics working with us where we really don't want to move away from it. And wanting to recover is as much a part of one's recovery as any. Yeah, that's a tremendous point. In a lot of these things, what may be the scariest, I'll say for myself, what's the scariest for me in much of this is that I don't feel like I can be honest about what I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. I might feel that there's something not right about it, or somehow I don't feel like I can say that to others, share that with others, be honest about that with others. And when people give you permission to simply feel what you're feeling, that's a great gift.
Would you recommend a formal support group for churches, or is it the more informal is the better?
By formal, you mean?
Well, say, you know, if you had cancer, or you're dealing with it, or, you know, whatever, you know, say, a loss of partner, or this type of thing. But are formal groups really better, or is it more, you know, just chance meeting and informal?
I can speak from my own experience, but other people want to...
AA has done better than anything else, and that's just a lay-led group.
Our church the men have formed a 12-step group, mm-hmm. which just deals with addictions,
mm-hmm.
and they're not the same addictions, but I found that to be very helpful. Mm-hmm. And what's really helpful are the rules,
mm-hmm.
and helping you...
But do you mean the 12 steps or other traditions?
The rules that govern the sharing.
Yeah.
That you talk only about yourself.
Yes.
And not about mm-hmm. other people, that mm-hmm. what you say stays in the group.
That's right. That's right.
And then we've modeled it after Alcoholics Victorious, which brings the scriptural mm-hmm. component mm-hmm. into it.
I was just going to say, to this woman's question, I think sometimes there are congregations that are able to rally around a particular issue informally, mm-hmm. and then sometimes they can't, and it needs some structural kind of support to make that happen. I mean, for instance, in cancer support kind of things, we had several people in our congregation that were struggling with cancer. Cancer was a little bitty congregation, but I just couldn't see those people standing together in coffee hour, because they didn't see each other much other, mm-hmm. standing there talking about the struggles that they were having with cancer. But I knew them well enough, and they knew each other well enough, that they were real willing to get together, you know, twice a month to deal with that. So I think it depends on what the needs are, and if you're not finding the support you need, to find someone within the congregation that can help you structure that.
Depends. Ours just started a support group for, I don't know if it's just for alcoholics, but they can call any time of the day or night. No matter what problem they have, and it's a private concern of each one.
I'm curious about something. I'm wondering what Jesus would have done as we talk, as we mm-hmm. enter into grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering about the ministry, whether I'm willing to enter into the process of life with other people. Because it takes... It calls me out of my laziness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just so easy to listen for 15, 20 minutes and care and be genuine in that. I'm not talking phony, I'm talking real caring.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering about a state of grace or a call to grace that says, and maybe it's not for everyone, I don't know, but for those of us who are here, for example, because we evidently have an interest here,
mm-hmm.
of entering in at a level that's not codependent, I'm not talking about
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
but that is willing to experience grief, for example, loss, is willing to experience depression. You know, I flee from depression. I hate it when I find myself getting there. It terrifies me when I get stuck in it. And I find that when I'm with people that are depressed, that the energy drain that I feel in being with those people is tremendous. So I would just as soon put up a barrier where I don't have to be, mm-hmm. and I think there's some cautions that have to go along with it. But I'm just wondering, at a deeper level, what the grace is in this thing. I don't know.
Can I just do a bit of reflecting? This is, I don't want to wax pastorally a lot, for a long time here, but I could. But for me, we have some beautiful images, I think, in Jesus' own life and ministry that help us with that, that I don't think we pay a lot of attention to. I mean, the tomb is the biggest one. I mean, Jesus walked into that. He set his face toward Jerusalem. And we are so eager for Easter, we get real uncomfortable really looking at Good Friday. You know, we feel sometimes sorry for Jesus, but we don't always understand that Paul said we are baptized into Christ's death. We are buried, therefore, with him by baptism. We go down in that same water, and our faith is that Jesus, God through Jesus, will raise us up again. But the images of being willing to kind of walk into the darkness, not to avoid it, but to walk into the darkness, to be willing. I don't know if we're always so willing to even let God kind of immerse us in that water. And this stuff, I mean, this is the darkness. It's right there for us. And we, the 23rd Psalm, you know, yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. I mean, who's walking? We're running. We don't want it. It's hard to be graceful enough with ourselves and to trust that God will bring us to a new place enough to walk through that valley. And it's remarkable that God can give us the faith to walk in that valley, to trust that even though we've been immersed in those waters, we are drowning in those waters, that we will emerge a new creation. But the imagery is all there. And it's more a matter of our understanding that that's the way it is and not just this hop to Easter.
I just flashed on something. If I can see that as not the black side of my life, I can see that as part of living.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Then I won't have as much energy around it. Maybe I'll work through it quicker.
Mm-hmm. I preached a sermon on Good Friday, which had as kind of as one of its themes, you know, how glad we are that Jesus died so we don't have to. And we talk sometimes about Jesus dying for us. I think sometimes we think, well, wonderful, he took on all the pain himself so that I don't have to take any. We don't realize that, I mean, on the one hand, you can say Jesus invites us into that kind of life. On the other hand, if we're human, we're there. We can either kind of go along willingly or not, but this stuff is us too, and we can either follow Christ in that and come to understand that Christ is with us, or we can fight it. And addiction is one way to fight it. Sometimes I call it an avoidance technique gone bad, but it's kind of trying to loosen ourselves from all that stuff that really is the beginnings of addiction and compulsion.
I've thought sometimes, you know, the scripture about the image of Christ as the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought at times in some of the experiences that I've had that there were people who took on that role with me that were so life-giving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they have to be, in some ways, not afraid of the pain. They have to believe that there's new life, not that they control it. I mean, that's the other side. Jesus didn't even control his resurrection. God raised him from the dead. So that when you enter with someone into their pain, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't even know that they're going to get better in their lifetime. Maybe the resurrection of the dead is when that recovery will finally happen. Because you can't make someone recover. But the trust that God is able to do something is, and to have images and a faith in some concrete symbols of that, for me, is as much hope and promise as I need to believe that something will happen.
I've come to believe that we are called in this life to learn lessons that are very individualized. They're collective, yes, but they're very individualized. Mm-hmm. And that as I look, and as I have a 28-year-old daughter, for example, who has been going through a lot of struggles, and together, you know, I've tried to not be codependent, because it's real easy when you're a mother and care immensely about somebody, mm-hmm, to want to fix it. You know, you don't want them to go through it. You know, and I've come to a point in my life where I realized, number one, I didn't have the energy, the energy to try to fix it anymore. Mm-hmm. I was to a point where I hear you, and I hear your pain, mm-hmm, and I love you, and I care, mm-hmm, and I'm here. But you are going to take up the lessons of your life, just like I have to learn the lessons in mine. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel real comfortable.
No.
But it's really healthy, and it's been very freeing to, mm-hmm, me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think, hopefully, they're more effective as I've tried to relate to her as an adult and as a person in her own right, and as her mother also.
But what a gift.
Without
a gift,
that codependent, yes, you know, fix up thing that I can get into.
There's D.H. Lawrence has a quote, which always jars me, because sometimes I tend to think of codependency as really just, you know, just a little bit of an abuse of caring. But he says, "You love me so much you would put me in your pocket and I would die there smothered." Mm-hmm. Person isn't free to live when in that kind of relationship. Neither is. Another thing that I heard in what you said, which can be a problem with in our own dealing with these, is that we're all different, we're all unique. And maybe, you know, maybe I handle stress better than some, but maybe I don't grieve as well. So I probably don't even notice, if I handle stress better, I don't even notice that I do that. But if it takes me 5 years to get over the situation over which I'm grieving, and the norm, you know, statistic, and you can go to, I mean, even books on general recovery or grief, or Elizabeth Kubler Ross or others, and 2.5 years, you know, that's when you should be at this point. Well, I'm not there, you know, I'm twice as long, and I still don't feel there. We don't understand our own humanness, our own uniqueness in that process. And again, can start feeling that something's wrong with us. And there's probably a fear that it may never go away. What if we carry that hurt with us? How do we live as humans with that hurt or pain? And that sometimes is enough anxiety, causes enough anxiety to want to medicate it. Because who knows that it will go away, really?
And I think it would be more honest if people in support areas could acknowledge that while the intensity may lessen,
yes,
over a period of time, you know, every time there's a birthday for your daughter, every time there's, mm-hmm, a holiday for your daughter, every, mm-hmm, time your other daughter does something that your, mm-hmm, dead daughter could,
yeah,
you know, that will bring that up again.
Sure.
And for somebody to say, you know, hopefully the intensity will lessen, but that's the rest of your life,
yeah,
you know, and make that okay,
mm-hmm,
you know, and acknowledge that that's okay.
What's funny about
it? You really are changed. Mm-hmm. You are,
yes,
not the same.
Oh,
I am not,
no,
the same.
No, no.
And
I
am
never
not
be
the same,
same
either,
no,
as a result of what I've experienced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The,
yeah,
brokenness is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we have to get away from feeling like the brokenness is ugly. Actually, maybe,
sure,
that's the beauty that it's the sandblasting or whatever that has to occur so that we see who we really are.
And when you lay out something like this, you can look at it a number of different ways, but I mean, it's hard to maintain when you lay it out like this. I'm grieving now, and I think, well, I get done with that. You know, I want that hurt to go away. Well, shoot, I'm just got all sorts. I mean, I'm not going to ever be in a position where I won't be hurting. There's too many options. You know, I mean, then we're talking about suicide again. It's the only way to be human and not hurt. So you're not very alive as a human.
I started a support group in Kansas for people who have neurofibromatosis, which is a medical disorder. And I have this disorder,
mm-hmm,
as well as,
mm-hmm,
members of my family. And I'm president of the Kansas chapter. And in trying to deal with it myself and accept it and the problems it's caused with our family, I have other people in the state of Kansas and in the surrounding states who call and talk with me directly. And at times they can really depress me,
mm-hmm,
because,
mm-hmm,
the problems they have with the disorder, but yet in a way it's strengthened me also, because they're helping me as I help them.
So, remember the words of the old hymn, "I will sanctify to you your deepest distress."
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what we're getting at.
Mm-hmm.
It's the beauty and the pain and the and ugliness and all the change and everything, and yet through Christ, I think the hope is that it can be sanctified.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And in the process, because we ourselves have experienced some healing and recovery, even if we're just at the beginning of it, when you know what's possible and you see so many other people out there that you know are ripe for the, you know, the fields are ripe to harvest. The laborers are few, but the harvest is ready. It's hard to keep going sometimes and to be able to set limits because you want to respond to everybody. And it's one of the struggles of recovery to know what God has given you to do. How much is possible, and at what point are you starting to help others at your own expense than getting to a place where you're really not helping others at all.